This week's romp through the bizarre tangles of my mind, we have the second installment of Monsters of the Midwest with the big muddy monster of Murfreesboro, Illinois. I talked to John Sellers, Executive Director Emeritus of the History Museum on the Square in Springfield, Missouri, about the Great Cobra Scare of 1953, a new edition of Brilliant After Dark, and this is the most romantic one yet. These curiosities and more await you, so stick around. I'm Alan Brill. Welcome to Brilliant, a podcast from the mind of Brill. Warning, it gets dark in here. Well, y'all, fake crime doesn't pay. And I dug through the files of oddness to find a couple of stories to illustrate this point. AuditDecentral.com, 31 December 2024. Mayor Tarapara, 32, turned up at a police station in Surat, India, claiming he had suddenly felt dizzy and passed out on the street, only to wake up 10 minutes later with four fingers missing from his left hand. Police initially thought his fingers might have been stolen for black magic rituals, but soon found massive holes in Tarapara's story. Pressed by police, he admitted he had cut off his fingers himself as he wanted to quit his job as a computer operator at a relative's company, but was too shy to resign, so he severed his fingers to make himself unfit for his post. Whew! Okay, well, a couple of things. One, I'm glad I live in a country where if I walk into a police station with four fingers missing, they don't just say, oh, yeah, probably somebody took them for black magic rituals. It happens all the time. It's a heck of a deal. It's easy to laugh at this guy chopping off his fingers because he's too shy to quit. But I don't think there's a lot of us that have worked in a job and been like, yeah, I would definitely hurt myself not to have to come back here. Well, I'm props to him. He went through with it. But fake crime cost him 4/5 of the fingers on his left hand. So I'm not sure that's a win. But hey, I bet he doesn't work there anymore. Next, we have Kathleen Newman, a 46-year-old divorced mother of two who staged an elaborate fake burglary to win back the affection of her neighbor, Paul Cockerell, in Brixworth, New Hamptonshire. On October 30th, 1998, she ransacked her house, tipping out the drawers, throwing jewelry on her bed. She piled electrical goods in the front room, taped her mouth, put a plastic bag over her head, and tied her hands together. Leaving her front door open, she lay across the front doorstep of her former lover. As she waited for his return from a pub, she vomited, and unable to remove the tape from her mouth as her hands were shackled with self-tightening plastic ties, she choked to death. Police at first treated the death as suspicious, but they reviewed the case and found that nothing had been taken, and she still had 918 pounds in her handbag. And that was from the Fortean Times Book of Strange Deaths. And, fake crime cost her life. Did not win back her lover, I assume. In the heart of Missouri lay Springfield, the birthplace of Route 66. Thousands of visitors come to this historic town every year. But in the summer of 1953, the city was host to some very unwanted and terrifying visitors. I have John Sellers, Executive Director Emeritus of the History Museum on the Square, to talk to us about this crazy summer. Mr. Sellers, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, good to be on.
So, it was a pretty interesting summer that year, eh?
Yeah, it was one, even though I was quite young, I remember it very well. for a multitude of reasons.
I can imagine. So there was a bit of a snake infestation, correct?
Yeah, it all started with a snake that got run over in the middle of the street at National in St. Louis. And the people that saw the snake in the middle of the street said, that's an odd-looking snake. Its head's very flat. So they took it down the street to a pet shop just down St. Louis Street and took it into the owner of the pet shop and said, have you ever seen a snake like this? And he identified it as a puff adder and said it was not poisonous. It was no problem with it. Not to worry about it. So nothing else was thought about it for a day or so, until another one was killed in a yard around on Trafficway Street, just north of St. Louis and Nashville. And that one, they took to the science teacher at Jarrett Junior High. And he goes, "Where in the world did you get this?" And they said, "Oh, it was a dog killed it in a yard on Trafficway Street." And he said, "Well, this is incredibly dangerous snake that's not indigenous to this area at all. It's a cobra. And somebody must have had it as a pet or something, because there's no way that this animal could be anywhere near here. It can't take the winter. It doesn't hibernate like a regular snake." And went through all the reasons that it just couldn't be right. But that started it, and soon they started to turn up a snake here and a snake there, all these cobras, about the same size, about apparently the same age. And people just went panic-stricken about it. And the reason I'm so familiar with it is because that was in the 1600 block of St. Louis Street where his pet shop was, and my house was in the 900 block of St. Louis Street.
Oh, man. Ground zero.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we lived in an apartment. It was an old house that had been converted into apartments. And so we had this house. There was just a small family. And my mother, the minute she heard about this, of course it was in the paper and everything, the minute she heard about it, she immediately knew that these snakes were going to attack her children.
Well, sure, sure.
So it's one of the hottest summers on record. The only one hotter was 1953. And she locked us up in the house. And the house had no air conditioning.
Oh, man.
It was incredible. The windows all shut, the doors all closed, everything.
Hard enough to be cooped up in the summer when you're young anyway, let alone.
Yeah, weren't getting your kids. So it was a very memorable, very memorable summer. They ultimately, some of the most curious occurrences, they were getting complaints that the city wasn't doing enough to capture these snakes. So the head of the health department and the chief of police came up with a plan. These snakes, they had visions of them from movies and God knows what else, of these snakes with a snake charmer playing a flute.
Right.
And you know, charming these snakes. So they thought, well, you know, we'll just get a truck with a big speaker and we'll play this snake charmer music and the snakes will come out and we can capture them or kill them. And not realizing that snakes can't hear.
Right.
The snake charmer music is to allow the snake charmer to rhythmically move from side to side, which the movement lulls the snake. So they had a whole group of young people with hoes and axes and shovels following this truck, driving like 5 miles an hour down the street, playing snake charmer music, trying to capture these snakes, just waiting for these snakes to come slithering out, attracted by this wonderful music.
You know, Tar.
And, of course, that didn't work.
Yeah, Tar, 2025 range, that's, of course, sounds ridiculous. Yeah. But I bet 1953, I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, and, you know, and you think about today, what it would have been like. There would have been television remote trucks parked all the way to Stratford.
Oh, yeah.
But in that day, we had one reporter from the AP and one reporter from Life magazine. And that was it. There was a nice article in Life magazine about it.
It's such an amazing story, you know, a small town in Missouri getting overrun by cobras. Yeah. And it'd be terrifying, too, because, snakes can get anywhere.
And then, like, 40 years later, Michael Bryan was editor of the newspaper at that time. Michael Bryan was a feature writer and a great guy. And one of his friends came to him and says, this has been weighing on me for the last 40 years, but I had to tell somebody. This guy, Ray O'Maurer, that owned the pet store, he would trade the local kids in the area tropical fish for snakes.
Huh.
And so this kid brought in some snakes, and he got some tropical fish, and the tropical fish didn't survive. They died. So he went back and complained about the fish dying, and Ray O'Maurer said, well, I'm sorry, you know, that's just your bad luck. And so he went outside and around behind the pet store to do some vandalism, just to get rid of his anger, and he turned over a big stack of crates, and a crate broke open, and all these snakes escaped.
Oh,
and
man.
He thinks, the assumption is that's how they got loose.
Now, is this the same pet shop owner that was like, oh, no, that's just a puff adder?
Yeah, exactly. The same pet shop owner that said, oh, that's just a puff adder. Don't worry about that.
And, of course, he would have been silent because, well, he didn't want to get blamed for it, number one.
Yeah,
number two, that's got to be illegal, right?
They did find out that he was dealing in illegal animals.
Okay, yeah.
So he right after this was all settled, he left town and didn't ever come back.
I can imagine. I just think about it would just be a terrifying situation anyway, because...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, go to the hospital, they, you know, would have antivenin for water moccasins, copperheads, rattlesnakes,
stuff like that.
Yeah. Not going to have no cobra.
No. That's not something you just keep lying around.
And they could
It was, and until the very first freeze, when everything froze, got cold and froze, that was when they were certain that the snakes wouldn't come back because they couldn't deal with that cold weather.
Yeah, which I'm very thankful for that.
So from late in the summer, like in August, all the way through to like October, everybody was living in panic, waiting for the next snake to show up.
Just worrying about your pets running around, or
everything.
Just what an amazing, very curious piece of history that is. You know, Midwestern Missouri.
And for years after that, there was a cobra on the seal of the city of Springfield.
Oh wow! Okay.
There was the city of Springfield's seal had a shield in the middle of it. And they added the cobra circled around that shield with its head up above the shield.
Wow, that's amazing. Just like I said, what a wonderful, wonderful piece of history that is. And just one of many that people can find if they go down to the museum on the square there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Comes alive and...
There we go.
Well, I thank you so much for joining me tonight and for coming on the show. Just like I said, it's an incredible Missouri story. And
glad to do it. I've got lots of them.
I might be calling you back then.
Give me a call.
I appreciate it.
Again, I'd just like to thank Mr. Sellers for coming on the show. And a cobra scare in Missouri. Who would have thunk it? I think one of my favorite parts of that story, and there's a lot of good ones, is... just the image of that bizarre parade of the truck slowly rolling up the street with the speaker in the back and the kids walking behind it with shovels and hose in hand ready to kill the serpents as they slither out onto the street. What a crazy thing to have witnessed. What a crazy thing to have happened. And I have a feeling that's not going to be the last time we talk to Mr. Sellers. And now we have the long-awaited, much-anticipated second installment of the Monsters of the Midwest. And we're heading down to Murfreesboro, Illinois, which can only mean one thing. That's right, the Big Muddy Monster. Now, in the 1940s and 1950s, large bipedal beasts were sighted and indeed hunted in the Murfreesboro area. A silver beast in the 40s and a darker one in the 50s, but I'm picking up this story in July of 1972, because this is where I feel the legend of the Big Muddy Monster really began. Now, some of y'all have been with me from from day one, episode one, the year 1972 may ring a faint bell or two for you monster fans out there, because that is when the Momo craze started with the sightings in the fall of that year in Louisiana, Missouri. And, you know, it's right, Louisiana, Missouri is just right across the river from Illinois, and Murfreesboro is around 130 miles from Louisiana as the Bigfoot strides. That's just something to keep in your mind. And if you want to hear more about Momo, go back to episode one of Brilliant and cover it there. Now, on July 25th, in Cairo, Illinois, and that's about 50 miles south of Murfreesboro, Leroy Summers was jogging late at night along the Ohio River levee in town when he saw a figure that stood 10 feet tall and had a large head. He didn't mention it, but I wonder if perhaps that was a pumpkin-shaped head like my beloved Momo had. But anyway, this creature was covered in long white hair with light red around the middle. At first, all he saw was a silhouette. So, I mean, I guess if he saw a silhouette, there's lighting nearby, but I don't know, it seems quite detailed for being dark, so I'd like to know more about the lighting situation. That's all. The red collar could have been caked on clay mud, or you know, maybe it was red hair. Anyway, he did the smart thing and hightailed it out of there and called the police as soon as he could. You know, it had to actually make it to a landline back in that day. And this guy, apparently, you know, he was credible because he was taken seriously enough that officers were dispatched to the scene. So there's that. They searched the area. It came up empty because the monster at this point had moved on. Like I said, it was probably quite a bit of time had passed since the initial sighting. Had to jog on back to a phone, call the police. They had to scramble to get out there. So that was the first in this series of sightings. And our next one, and we know this one thanks to Troy Taylor, who went back and really researched it and dug this up. It wasn't highly reported before then. But in September, a woman living in Kell, and that's about 50 miles northeast of the Murfreesboro area. Well, 50 miles northeast of Murfreesboro. It's still the Murfreesboro area. Witnessed a, quote, very large beige-collared creature crouching at the edge of the woods near her home. She had several dogs who barked wildly and charged the beast, but they, you know, they charged the beast, but they remained a safe distance away. Then it stood up, took a step forward, and the dog scrambled across the yard and ran into the house. The lady followed right behind them and didn't leave for quite some time, which, again, is the correct decision, I feel, in that situation. Although, our beast there, not too monstrous, just kind of hanging out, getting harassed by the local dogs, but hey, I can dig it. Now, on June 8th, 1973, some campers and their German Shepherd were chased out of their camp in Prairie du Rocher, about 50 miles north of Murfreesboro, by escalating screeches, growls, and the violent shaking of the trees surrounding the campsite. The owners had also observed that they were missing, quote, a lot of sweet molasses horse feed, and that the barn doors of the little campground area of the farm were often mysteriously opened. When, you know, they shut the barn door every night, come in, it's open, and they're missing sweet molasses horse feed. Take that as you will. Again, dog got chased out of the area. Very brave dog, German Shepherd, very loyal breed, so something pretty scary out there. But now we get what, for me at least, is the main event. On June 25th, 1973, in Riverside Park, which runs along the bank of the Big Muddy River in Murfreesboro, a midnight rendezvous was interrupted in a terrifying manner. 19-year-old Randy Needham and 28-year-old Judy Johnson were parked near the boat ramp in Murfreesboro. An ungodly shriek pierced the night, and Needham saw, quote, a 7-foot-tall, mud-covered man walk towards them. Now, they tore out of there and raced to the police station, and at 11:55 p.m., made an official report. Okay, let's just pause the narrative here and take a little moment to address the relationship between Randy and Judy. Judy, 9 years his senior, was married, and it wasn't to Randy. I'm not shaming anyone here. The only reason I mention this is it does impact how I view the story in terms of credibility, because whatever happened shook them so badly that they were willing to reveal their affair. So, yeah. Also, I'd like to take this time to point out that the big muddy monster is a cockwalker. And that's not cool, dude. Now, I really, throughout the story, and I have to give mad props to the police here, because throughout it all, they took it serious. They filed official reports, and it's all documented on a official police paperwork. So, good on them. Now, the official report, Johnson initially said it was too dark, and she was, quote, unable to see the creature. And later, she is quoted giving a first-hand description, which is problematic when you have conflicting, you know, reports. Especially after some fame comes and you're like, oh no, I saw it all. That can put a little suspect on it. But given the circumstances, it very easily could be that she was trying to keep her name out of the report. Remember, she was cheating on her husband at this time. And so whenever they questioned her, she's like, oh, there's no reason to have my name in this report. I didn't see anything, didn't hear anything. And I assume if you're committing adultery, you probably don't want your name in the report. Randy, however, he was all about it. He reported the creature was covered with, quote, light-colored hair, matted with mud. He said it kept screaming as it approached the car. Its roar was, quote, changing tones, and its screams becoming growls. Johnson observed, no human would be able to scream or make a noise as loud as what we heard. Now, officers Nash and Lindsay were dispatched to the scene, and Needham returned to the area with Deputy Scott to show exactly where the encounter had happened. According to the police report, they found impressions in the mud approximately 3 to 4 inches deep, 10 to 12 inches long, and approximately 3 inches wide. A deeper search revealed more tracks, but they are radically spaced, with some being found 5 to 6 feet apart, and some being found really close together. Now, to me, at least, the highlight event of the investigation occurred at an estimated 3 a.m. Nash and Scott were investigating near the water's edge when Nash bent to examine a track, and a shrill, loud screech rang out so loudly that Nash dropped his firearm. He and Scott fled, and he didn't even retrieve his gun. He just left it at the scene. To lose your service weapon is a big damn deal, y'all. And it was only much later that he returned to the area to retrieve it. Thankfully, it was still there. And Nash said this about the noise he heard. No screech owl, no coyote. I don't know what it was. To leave his weapon is an honest and genuine fear reaction. Something extraordinary was out there. That's what I believe. On June 26, 1973, 5-year-old Christian Barrel was catching fireflies in his yard when he ran into the house, exclaiming that there was a big white ghost out there. 10 minutes later, a few houses down, 3 teens saw something abnormal in their backyard. Randy Kreith, Cheryl Ray, and an unnamed friend were on the patio when they saw a large creature walking on 2 legs. It casually strolled into a field, and Cheryl hurriedly turned on the porch light while Kreith ran to get a closer look. Which, good on these teens, that's pretty courageous. And what he saw was, quote, a 7 to 8 feet tall creature that he estimated to be 300 to 350 pounds. And they all noticed a river smell and all said it had a light hair covered in mud. Ray also said it had, quote, very large shoulders and very long arms. Now, there have been reports of Kreith stating that the creature had glowing red eyes, but it can't be verified. Nobody ever found the source of him making this claim. It just kind of got spread throughout the media. So maybe he said it, maybe he didn't, maybe it's just part of the legend. But it's worth noting that some reports have him saying that the creature had the glowing red eyes. The police were called, and our man Nash, and this time paired up with Manwaring, came out to investigate, and they found the path. and they called in Jerry Nellis, who was a dog handler. Now, Nellis and his 80-pound German Shepherd, Reb, arrived at the place where the beast was last sighted and began tracking, and went down a hill, and according to the police statement, Reb kept stopping and sniffing at a slime substance on the weed, which appeared periodically. Now, each time he came across it, Reb would hesitate. Now, I think if this was just regular river mud or a river slime, the dog wouldn't be so interested, and it wouldn't hesitate every time it encountered it. And the police wouldn't be so interested in it at all. And in the report, they would just call it, you know, river mud or a river slime. It makes me think this is a little something more to the substance that they found. But, you know, I don't know. That's speculation on my part, which is mostly what we do on this show. Now, Reb led him down the hill to a wooded area and refused to back off when he came to terrain that was just too rugged for the humans to follow. So they took Reb back to the car, and they found a way around the obstruction. And then when they came on the other side, like, well, hopefully the monster went straight through. So they went and got the dog, got Reb, brought him there to see if he could pick up the trail. Which, I mean, talking about Reb here, of course he could pick up the trail. And he took him, picked up the trail, and they took him to a barn, and he steadfastly refused to enter the barn. He stood there, he barked, but he would not go in it. This is 80-pound German Shepherd, loyal breed, afraid of nothing. Nellis would actually shove him in the barn, and he'd immediately run back out. Now, Nash and Nellis, mad props, they pulled their weapons and immediately searched the barn. Nash didn't drop his gun this time. And Nellis told the papers that he had never seen Reb back down before, but when they searched the barn, they found nothing. So, yeah, it must be a scent in the air so strong that this dog was not having it. But by the time police got in there, monster was gone, and they didn't pick up the trail again after that. Now, in the 70s alone, there were 15 more sightings, and another credible sighting in 88, and I imagine a whole slew that went unreported by people that seen it and talked to each other, but, you know, didn't officially report it at this time. And I get the impression there was quite a few more that were not credible. But, you know, I got to think with all this hubbub and everything that something was definitely going on in Murfreesboro in 72 and 73. But what was it? What was going on? And I think we really... it comes down to either there was a Bigfoot-type creature roaming the area surrounding Murfreesboro, or everybody was lying, or it was all a hoax. I mean, that's really the three options. I don't believe that Randy Needham and Judy Johnson, you know, are forbidden lovers who are parked by the boat ramp. I don't think that they were lying. The reporting of this creature, this beast, it exposed the affair, but they saw something that scared them, but they could have been victims of a prank, victims of a hoax. That remains to be seen, but I don't believe they were lying. Now, the police took these sightings very seriously, and something scared Officer Nash enough to leave his service weapon behind. So, there's something was going on. And there were tracks left behind as far as evidence. And, you know, let's not forget our good boy Reb tracked something into a barn that he refused to enter. And we also have several more, you know, anecdotal sightings of this mysterious creature. So, I mean, yeah, there's enough there. Something was going on. So, let's look at it. Now, I don't believe that all these people were making it up, and not all of the sightings were a case of misidentification. So let's just move past that, shall we? Now, most of the people interviewed on this wave of sightings dismissed the idea of a Joker running around in a costume because, as a lot of them pointed out, Southern Illinois is gun country. This doesn't rule it out for me. There's some stupid people out there that would dismiss that and do it anyway. Occasionally we do hear about people being killed by doing such a prank. And so it doesn't rule it out for me, but it, I am inclined to agree. And also, I think a lot of the sightings, they were enough detail that it wasn't just a guy in a cheap-ass suit he made at home. And remember, this was 72, 73, so costumes weren't nearly as advanced as they are today. A moron in a homemade suit would not be very convincing. And I don't think that Reb would be afraid of a human in a suit. Now, we got the tracks, and there is a decent witness that claims her father created the tracks, and she even remembers seeing the plywood feet hanging up in the garage. Her dad since gave them to a family friend, so they're no longer in evidence. They're not in play. And but still, it's a good witness, and it's reasonable. Now, because there were other tracks discovered throughout this rash of sightings, and so they could have been fake, but I don't think that the tracks found the night of the boat launch sighting could have been fake, because he would have had to have been Johnny on the spot, and he would have had to make these tracks all while evading detection from the police. But some of the later tracks, he definitely could have faked. Okay, all right. Guess I gotta talk about Willie. Gotta talk about a man hiding behind the alias Willie. Now, in their 2011 book, History, Mysteries, and the Hauntings of Southern Illinois, Bruce and Lisa Klein claim that the 1973 hoax was pulled off by a shared acquaintance of theirs. Now, he is, they claim, a credible but eccentric witness. He's a sci-fi fanatic and a maker of sci-fi costumes for movies, and according to them, a very, very talented one. Now, he claims to have crafted a highly realistic monster costume, and together with a few friends, set out to scare teenagers at the boat ramp, as one does. And, you know, the boat ramp was a popular parking spot, so I guess if you wanted to go scare teenagers, that's what you do, and why not make a highly realistic costume and get a gang of friends to pull this off. Ha ha. That's a fun night there. But anyway, it's, I guess, possible. And, you know, just the costume wasn't enough. There was also the smell. So he thought this through, and just an extra added touch, just to put the prank over the top, they mixed up a highly potent, quote, stink juice. And while the man they had wearing the costume approached the car, the rest of the group distributed the stink juice throughout the area to create this overpowering smell. I mean, sure, really gets a kick out of scaring teenagers, I guess. Now, he never came forward officially because he was too afraid of the legal ramifications, of which there weren't any legal ramifications. And in fact, in later years, the authors of the book, The Big Muddy Monster, my main source for this story, excellent book, they approached him and had a statement from the sheriff's office that said, hey, no charges brought against him, just want the answers, but nope, still wouldn't do it. Now, not only did he keep this secret, but all the other members of his stink juice gang kept the secret as well, never came out with what really happened. It's possible this is a true story, and that's what happened that night, but I find it a little ridiculous, but judge it for yourself. And I know as I read it and write it, looking back now, I kind of put my own spin, my own little bias there. But I dig through it, judge for yourself. Like I said, it's a no-go for me, but yeah, I wasn't there, I don't know. And, but this, the disdain in my voice, let me just go on a little rant here, okay? Just for a little bit, get this off my chest. There have been a lot of cases where people have claimed to have hoaxed, you know, monster sightings, and it's later proven they lied about it, that they couldn't do it. So why do you lie about hoaxing the monster sightings. Why are you claiming responsibility for it? And, you know, this is my personal thought, is that they're just, you know, sad little people who just want so badly to be smarter than everybody else, and they can say, hey, I fooled them all. All them people are so dumb. I tricked them, yes, sir, because I'm so much smarter than they are. And, you know, that's why you lie about it. That's why you fake it. And that's why some people lie about having monster sightings. It's like, oh, no, I'm special. I saw the monster even when they didn't. And that happens as well. And, you know, some people are like, oh, this is ridiculous. So I'm going to show everybody it's ridiculous because it threatens the way I see the world. And so maybe you lie about a hoax there. And, yeah. You know, I'm just going to go off on some of the debunkers out there as well, because they number one, they come up with a lot of scenarios that disregard several facts, discard what hurts their case, and picks up what doesn't. And so they bias it that way. And also, a lot of times, the solution that they come up with, like, oh, that's not what happened. It was clearly had to have been this. And it's so complicated and absurd, and rather than just say, I don't know what happened, I can't explain it, I don't think it was supernatural, but I don't know what happened. I don't know is an answer I can respect. I can get behind that, but, you know, I'm gonna stop here before I get too fired up. All right, back to Big Muddy. There are numerous sightings spanning many more years. Some, I imagine, were just straight-up lies, and I think some are misidentification. And some, I believe, and, you know, I'm going to go with it because it's my show. I think some of them were legit. I believe that a Bigfoot-type monster was prowling around Murfreesboro. But, as always, you know, decide for yourself. And, take everything, look at it, put your own spin on it, and then agree with me because I'm right. No, I'm kidding. Of course, make up your own mind. And, yeah, I can respect it. We can all be friends even if you don't believe it. But, you know, just listen to each other's views and respect each other's opinions, because at the end of the day, none of us really know anything. Okay, a little note here about something interesting that you might be wondering about. White Bigfoots are actually reported pretty often. Not as common as, like, the darker ones, but it's not exactly rare either. And we'll look at that on a later episode, or probably more likely several episodes when I get around to covering the big guy. And, I just want to take my hat off to the Murfreesboro police there, who did an excellent job documenting this and making it official. And also, I'm going to tip my hat to Murfreesboro itself, who they celebrate their local cryptid. Each year in October, they hold the Big Muddy Monster Brew Fest. And they hold it on the location of the Needham Johnson sightings. Microbreweries from all over the area, they converge. There's bands, plenty of Big Muddy Monster gear to buy. Monsters, beer, and live music. Enough said, there's also a Big Muddy Run held annually. And several of the local restaurants have a Big Muddy Monster item on their menus. And, you know, whether you believe or not, whether you take it seriously or not so much, it's a lot of fun. And it's a pretty damn cool mascot at the end of the day. Now, the awesome team at Chad Lewis, Noah Voss, and Kevin Lee Nelson authored the book, The Big Muddy Monster, which I relied heavily on for the story because they did all the work. I didn't even have to look around that much. It's meticulously researched, and it's a fantastic book, and I highly recommend it. Check it out, read it, make up your own mind. But give them a shot. They've wrote several books, and they're all excellent. I really respect what they do and how they do things. Okay, all right, guys. If you got a little ears listening, it's that time of the show where you might want to send them away. Or normally I know about how long it's going to be. I tell you to skip ahead, but this is the last segment. So if not your cup of tea, or you got little ears, go ahead and bail out now, and I'll talk to you next week, and come on back. But for those of you sticking around, it's time to pull the shades. dim the lights, and snuggle up with the one you love, because it's time for Brilliant After Dark. All right, guys, get ready for what is the most romantic edition of Brilliant After Dark yet. Now, I understand, and frankly, you're right to be suspicious, but this installment, this is a real-life version of a fairy tale. Seriously, it parallels Snow White almost exactly. I mean, if Prince Charming was a vile, disgusting morgue attendant, that's a difference. But anyway, here we go. Listen to it, and you'll see that I'm right here. Once upon a time, 1992, in a faraway magical land, Romania, a beautiful young maiden who was 18 lay on a cold slab in a morgue after being declared clinically dead. Everyone was terribly heartbroken. But then the fair maiden regained consciousness while being raped by a Bucharest morgue attendant. The shocked would-be necrophiliac was arrested, but the maiden's parents refused to press charges because he had saved their daughter's life. It wasn't exactly a kiss that woke up the fair maiden, but still, real-life fairy tale, Romanian style. Yeah, one small difference there. But anyway, what really caught my attention about this story was that line, the parents refused to press charges. Okay, first off, I guess I do things differently in Romania, but shouldn't it be the girl's decision whether or not to press charges? She was 18, even if she wasn't, should still be her decision there. You know what? It doesn't even matter. You gotta lock up this vile guy, right? I mean, he needs to be locked up and removed from society. And the second thing about that sentence was a guy rapes what he believed to be the corpse of their daughter and they turn him into a hero? No. He's a sick, sick puppy. Again, needs to be removed from society, not celebrated. Obviously be happy she's alive, of course, and celebrate the fact that you have her back, and it is a miracle, and be joyful, and just also understand that this is a case of something wonderful coming from a foul and vile act, and the happy outcome doesn't nullify the foulness of the act. This guy, he's no hero, even though the result was good. Don't give him a pass on this. Anyway, there's your modern-day fairy tale, Brain After Dark style. All right, I imagine after that last story, you're looking for the exit doors. Well, they are right this way and down the haunted hallways of my mind. And as you step out and you enter the normal world, I would just like to caution you to be careful, because it can get dark out there.